Hello, I'm Gillian Finley, sitting in for Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. The unmistakable chatter of happy children. These particular girls were recorded in Meru, Kenya. But there's nothing remotely happy about their circumstances. They're all staying at a shelter for victims of rape. The shelter is ground zero for a potentially historic legal case that could have repercussions far beyond Kenya. Human rights lawyers, including Canadian women, are taking the Kenyan government to court this summer on behalf of the victims. They say the government has failed to enforce laws that protect women from sexual assault. In a moment, we're going to hear from one of those Canadian lawyers. But first, some of the girls tell their stories. And please note that some of the details may not be appropriate for younger listeners. We'll hear first through a translator from two sisters, Charity, aged 11, and then later 6-year-old Susan. Their mother is dead, and they lived with their father.
She came out of school before her brother. His name is Mwendwa. She found the father in the house. The father asked her to remove the panties, and I jumped on his bed, and he raped me. Nicho kila kwikeke, Susan.
Daddy.
My dad put his penis between my legs. I believe my dad should be jailed.
Those interviews were originally recorded by journalist Sally Armstrong for a documentary on the CBC radio program Ideas. Sally also spoke with 11-year-old Emily just 6 days after she was raped by her grandfather. He told her he needed a flashlight and he called her into his room.
When she went into the house to show him where the torch was, he came in and took her by force and warned her not to scream, otherwise he would cut her up. Then he removed her clothes. Then he laid on top of her. Then her brother walked in with a panga, a machete, and then she had a chance to run away.
Now, Fiona Sampson has also been gathering these stories for when the rape victims take on their government. She's a Toronto-based human rights lawyer and one of the main forces behind the initiative they're calling 160 Girls. She recently returned from Kenya, where she was collecting expert evidence for the case, and she's with me now in the studio in Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how you got there is a whole story, and I will get to that eventually. But first of all, tell us more about the girls that we've been listening to. Who are these?
So these girls are members of the collective that we know as 160 Girls. They are all girls from northeastern Kenya who are victims of rape. Under Kenyan legislation, the term used is defilement. They are all between the ages of 3 and 17 years old. Girls as young as 3 months are raped in Kenya. Our youngest girl, the youngest of the 160 girls, is 3 years old. They've been raped by family members, by teachers, by members of their community, neighbors, landlords. They've also been raped by the police, which is particularly problematic as the police are supposed to be enforcing the laws that are designed to protect these girls. And all of these girls are part of this initiative that we are calling 160 Girls, designed to provide access to justice for the girls.
160 girls because
there were initially 160 girls that had been through the shelter that the Equality Effect, the organization that's coordinating this initiative, is partnered with a shelter on the ground in Kenya. And at the time that we adopted the initiative, there had been 160 girls through the shelter that had received treatment and care.
I mean, it's remarkable to hear those little tiny voices talking about such awful, ugly things. Why is rape in Kenya so prevalent?
Well, I think that rape, and particularly defilement, the rape of young girls in Kenya is so prevalent for a couple of reasons. One is this myth that having sex with a virgin will cure a man's HIV/AIDS. And the second part of that myth, which is even more disturbing and problematic, is that the younger the girl, the stronger the cure. So there's this very disturbing mythology that feeds into the problem. And that's part of the issue. And I think at the same time, the problem is rooted in the fact that it's become normalized. And because the police are not enforcing the laws that exist to protect girls, there's this climate of impunity that's developed. And the perpetrators, I think, feel that they can engage in this violence without repercussions. So the rate of this crime has actually been increasing in recent years. Our partners on the ground have been doing public education, trying to persuade men to stop engaging in this perverse and violent behavior. They've been doing that education for over 20 years, and the problem, from documentation that the Kenyan Bar Association has done in the last few years, we know the problem is actually getting worse, not better, and that every 30 minutes a girl or a woman is raped in Kenya. So it is an extremely serious problem that is growing.
I'm speaking with Canadian lawyer Fiona Sampson in Toronto. But before we continue, let's hear from the woman who's responsible for launching this case. Mercy Chidi runs the girl shelter in Meru, the one you've been hearing about, and it's at the foot of Mount Kenya. I reached her earlier.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How did you get involved in helping the girls in your community who'd been raped?
The program started in about 2007 in a response to the high need of girls who have been sexually abused within the community. And we have an outreach program where we work with children who have been orphaned due to HIV and AIDS. And in the course of our community outreaches, we came across children who would tell us they don't want to share beds with their father. And many of these girls were child-headed households, or they lived with an uncle or our grandparents, and most times they'll come to us and we'd offer counseling, but then they'll go back to the same abusive homes. And the more we listened to their stories, the more we found a need to have a temporary shelter where the girls who are facing different form of abuse can come and receive counseling, medical attention, and also legal support. So this, the shelter started in 2007, but we started working with children within the community in 2002.
You know, we just heard some of those little girls' voices, and it's heartbreaking. How has the work changed for you over the years? Are there more girls coming now than there were?
Yes, I would say we've had many more girls, because when we started, we only had about 10 girls. But now the number has grown. We have been able to rescue more than 249 girls, actually almost getting to 260 girls, including the ones that we are supporting in the community. For me, it's not necessarily that there have been more and more rape cases that are happening in the community, but the fact is, in our program, we have what we call child abuse prevention and intervention, and we've done a lot of community awareness for prevention. And the girls now have been sensitized that there's somewhere they can get help. And because of that, now we are getting more and more cases are coming to the shelter.
And what do you do to help the girls that come to the shelter?
When the girls come to the center, one of the things that the service we offer is many of them come when they are very traumatized. So we offer trauma assessment and treatment. And then we also do medical, because many of them have been sexually abused and they require medical care. And then the counseling is ongoing. Some of them who have complicated cases, we network with other hospitals like Nairobi Women's Hospital to make referrals for maybe reconstructive surgeries. And then apart from that, we do legal redress. Maybe guiding the caregivers of those children, mainly who are the grandmothers, on how they can access legal support for the girls, maybe recording statements, collecting medical evidence. And then we also do child witness support, whereby most of the children have never been to a courthouse. So we prepare them as witnesses in court, either because they are a victim of a crime or they have witnessed a crime. So in a nutshell, those are some of the basic services that we offer at the center.
Looking forward to this particular court case, what is its significance? What is it going to mean?
I think for me it's going to be very historic, and the success is not only going to be for the children in Meru, but we are looking at it as a success for all the children and women in Kenya, not just in Kenya but beyond, because one of the things that we know in Kenya is we have very good laws that protect women and children. Unfortunately, the people who are supposed to be enforcing those laws do not enforce the laws, especially the police. And many of the cases, we lose them when we go to court because the prosecution, most times with the police, fails to prove the case because they do very shoddy investigations. And many times they do not do the investigations at all. So more times you lose the cases. So in this particular case, which we are doing, which we are holding the police accountable for failing to protect these girls, we are hoping the case is going to be ruled in our favor and the police can be held accountable for failing to protect these girls. And this can ensure they come up with certain procedures on ensuring that investigations are done the way they're supposed to be done and the laws that exist that protect women and children can be enforced.
But in order for that to happen, these girls are going to have to come forward and they're going to have to tell their stories again. How difficult is that going to be for them?
Unfortunately, yes. That is the only way we're able to prove our case. The girls have gone through a lot of counseling in preparation for this. And the victory is going to be for thousands of other girls and women who have faced the same.
And is that helping them to have the courage to step forward and to speak publicly about this?
That has really given them the courage, and most of them, together with their guardians, when we started talking about them, they didn't even think twice because they already know the challenges, and they already received maybe being attended by the police.
What are people in the community, what are people in Kenya saying about this case?
To be honest with you, we've tried to handle it as quiet as possible because we also know, again, the implications on going public right now. I would say we have not really gone public here in Kenya about it because we are still gathering the evidence and trying to make it a strong case. So we've tried to, of course, you know how it goes, the intimidation, the threat that you can receive that could be a threat, that could be risky to the girls, could be risky to the guardians, can be risky to our own staff, themselves. So what we've tried to do is we've tried to handle this as quiet as possible until we file the case in court. So this time around, we have not really gone public about it. The only people who may be knowing about it is the guardians of the children that we are working with on this legal suit. Apart from that, other people, we've really kept it quiet because we don't want the children and the guardian to begin getting threats before we've actually filed the case.
Do you worry about the reaction when it finally does become public?
Of course, it's very natural to get worried, especially when you live in a country where people are easily threatened and intimidated. So it's quite scary. We are not exactly sure how it's going to turn. We don't have a reference of a similar case where we can say this is how this case went and this is how it was ruled.
But when you say scary, what are you afraid of?
Maybe of this directly touches on the police force, and they can be very intimidating. We've seen in the past some of the things that they've done to some of the civil society organizations, including maybe beating, including some of them unjustly being arrested and locked. So that's why we've been handling it very quietly until that time when we can go to court and maybe go public about it. But again, we are saying we can't just sit back and say we are scared, there's nothing we can do about it. Somebody has got to do it, and that's where we are committed and want to pursue this, not just for these girls, but for every girl, child and women in Kenya.
Mercy Chidi, thank you so much, and good luck with your work.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Mercy Chidi runs a shelter for girls, and she was in Meru, Kenya. Fiona Sampson's with me in our Toronto studio, and she's one of the lawyers involved in the 160 Girls Initiative that began in that shelter. Fiona, are they right to be worried?
You know, I think Mercy is the expert in terms of the Kenyan context, and I think when she says she's concerned and she's scared, then that's an authentic voice that we have to hear. I think there will be measures that we can take to try and increase the security for the frontline lawyers that are actually going to be litigating the case, and for the shelter workers and the guardians, but there will be security concerns. I think that's right.
She makes the point that in Kenya that there are indeed very good laws on the books protecting women against rape. There's no question about that. Clearly, they're not being enforced. Why?
Well, I think that the problem is in terms of enforcement that the police are not really inspired or motivated to effectively enforce the legislation. They really are failing to provide the protection that they are obligated to provide under the legislation, because there are no repercussions when they fail to enforce the legislation. These girls are the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. They until now have had no voice. They've had no power. So the police can fail to enforce the legislation and can actually engage in defilement themselves without any repercussions. So the goal of this action, the goal of the Equality FX 160 Girls case, is actually to ensure that the police do enforce the existing legislation, and that's what makes this a piece of landmark litigation.
What is the exact legal remedy that you're looking for? What do you want the courts to do?
So what we are doing, we considered different options, bringing a civil suit, a criminal case, a constitutional claim, some kind of combination of those different options. And after an extensive amount of research and strategizing by the legal team, and there is a huge legal team behind this initiative. It's not one or two people. It's not just me and Mercy. It is a legal team made up of volunteers from across Canada, the UK, including Sherry Blair, our honorary counsel, volunteers from the US and across Africa. So all of these amazing volunteers have been working together to build a constitutional claim. And this constitutional claim is the technique or the strategy, the mechanism that we're using to argue that the girls' human rights have been violated by the police failure to protect them from violence and to enforce these existing laws. So we will use the new Kenyan constitution that was introduced almost 2 years ago, which includes excellent provisions designed to advance the human rights of women and girls and other vulnerable groups. And we'll use that Kenyan constitution to hold the police accountable and to ask the court for an order that the police actually provide access to justice for the girls and enforce the existing laws that are meant to protect them.
How did you get involved?
So I got involved when I first met Mercy Chidi here in Toronto. Mercy was attending an international human rights program at the University of Toronto, and Mercy and I were introduced to each other by one of her professors, who was also a member of the Equality Effect Advisory Committee, Mary Aberts, and Mary thought we should meet. So Mary introduced us. And it was a bit of love at first sight, really. Mercy and I connected in a very concrete way. Mercy is working on the ground and was really feeling a need, I think, to identify legal remedies for systemic discrimination issues. And what the Equality Effect does is provide support and direction and guidance for women and girls in Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi, who are looking to advance their human rights and improve their lives. So Mercy, I think, was motivated by a story that she told me about a little girl named Millie who had been through the shelter. She's one of the 160 girls. She had she had been to Millie's village with her, and Millie had been at a community meeting. And Millie and Mercy were sitting in this community meeting in this very small space. Everybody's sort of jammed in there together, the whole village. And they're talking about routine issues like access to water and division of grazing lands, that kind of thing. And the meeting's wrapping up, and the chief says, is there anybody else who wants to make a contribution or has anything else to say in terms of this meeting? And Millie puts up her hand, and Mercy didn't know this was coming, and Millie puts up her hand and says that she has a question. So the chief allows her to speak, and Millie stands, and she's holding her baby. And Millie is about 13 years old at this time. And Millie says, I have this baby, and I have this baby that I don't want. And I have this baby because that man, and she points at a man standing at the edge of the room, she says, that man raped me. And she says, I have this baby, and I can't go to school because I have this baby, and I'm not free to walk the streets. But he is free, and I want to know what you're going to do about it. So Millie puts this to the community, and Mercy said that you could feel the oxygen get sucked out of that building that day. And nobody had an answer for Millie, and Mercy didn't have an answer for Millie. And Mercy says that that day it occurred to her that she had been mopping the floor, that rescuing the girls and doing the great work of providing treatment and care to the girls was not addressing the root source of the problem here, which is the failure of the police to provide protection for the girls and to address the systemic root cause of the issue. So she decided she needed to turn off the tap and stop mopping the floor, and she asked the Equality Effect to provide support to help them find a legal remedy for this problem.
You have your own personal story, personal reasons for getting so involved in this issue and in others. What is that?
Well, I think my interest in human rights issues comes from my own personal experience as a disabled woman. I'm a victim of thalidomide. I'm the last victim of thalidomide born in Canada. And I think that that experience as a disabled woman gives me an affinity for the experiences of other disadvantaged persons and really motivates me to address injustices like this that really demand attention. So I think that is that personal motivation that helps to inspire. But in this case, I would say it's the courage and fortitude of the girls on the ground, mm-hmm. and the amazing courage and fortitude of the shelter workers who, along with Mercy, are out there every day rescuing these girls. And even without going public on this case, they get death threats and rape threats on a regular basis and are determined to get justice for these girls in the face of those kinds of risks. And that really is the motivation behind this work.
So you're hoping to go to court in the fall. Is that right? The end of the summer?
In the next few months, yes.
It's obviously going to be a long process. But even if you prevail, even if you get a judgment that on paper is going to hold somebody accountable, is it really going to change something in Kenya?
So the 160 Girls Project is a long-term initiative. Legal change is a long-term project, but it does result in long-term concrete, meaningful change. And there will be an implementation period that follows the court's decision. There could be an appeal coming out of the initial decision, and it could be some time before we actually get to implementation on the ground. But we will ensure that when we get the court order in our favor, that it is implemented.
All right. Fiona Sampson, thanks so much for coming in.
All right, thank you.
Fiona Sampson is a Canadian human rights lawyer involved with the 160 Girls Initiative. And finally, we're going to close this discussion with one more story from one of the other girls at the shelter in Meru. Lucky Line became pregnant at 15 after she was sexually assaulted by a neighbor. She's proud to be part of the legal effort to make sure other girls don't suffer the same fate. Lucky Line's dream is to become a poet one day. Here she is reading one of her poems for journalist Sally Armstrong.
These pages, golden pages, healing pages, vultures pages, written by sages over ages, celebrating timeless pages, pages of the book that I am. I show the way, I lead the way, I show to pray, I make your day, I never lead astray. Thou should not kill, thou should not steal. Thou should not commit, for the wages of sin is death. Who wants to die? Here I come, walking down through history to eternity, from paradise to the city of goods, victorious, glorious, serious and pious, elegant, full of grace and truth, the centerpiece and the masterpiece of literature, glowing, growing, and flowing, here, there, and everywhere, cheering millions every day, the book of books that I am.
That is our program for today. Stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 with Q with Gian Gameshi, and be sure to watch CBC Television at 10 o'clock tonight for The National with Peter Mansbridge. Now, a little earlier, we heard Dan Rather's last words as CBS anchorman. Mr. Rather was also famous for a peculiar kind of saying that sounded a little bit like folk wisdom, except most of the wisdom had never been heard before or since. Here's a couple of examples. He tried to ramp up excitement with lines like, "It's getting hotter than a Times Square Rolex." Sometimes it wasn't clear what he was getting at. People are still trying to decode, "If a frog had side pockets, he'd carry a handgun." Well, during election nights, the Ratherisms flowed like white lightning from a hot Texas still. Ratherisms are certainly personal, unique, and attest to a certain kind of, well, courage. Here's a little more of the man in his own words. I'm Jillian Findlay. Anna Maria Tremonti will be back with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The Current.
8:30 p.m. in the East. It won't mean a thing if they don't get those swing states, and three of the big ones are still hanging.
I know that you'd rather walk through a furnace in a gasoline suit.
No question now that Kerry's rapidly reaching the point where he's got it back to the wall, his short tail's on fire, and the bill collector's at the door. His presidential race has been, you know, it's been cracking like a hickory fire for at least the last hour and a half or 2 hours. And John Kerry has his lead is as thin as turnip soup. Right now, we can say that this situation in Ohio would give an aspirin a headache.